History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then being willing to patiently listen as memories from long ago start to return to the forefront again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 80th anniversary of the Bataan Death March, one of World War II's most infamous incidents. We've heard from several survivors of the march over the years here on Hometown Heroes, and we're going to make that the focus of our program next time, perhaps with a highlight or two from commemorations taking place this week around the country and around the world. But I promise that this time we would conclude the story of Duane Harvey from the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment. Mr. Harvey has spent the last couple decades in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he is a voracious reader and student of history, so surely he could tell you quite a bit about the Bataan Death March and the fact that New Mexico had more men on that tragic march than any other state. While he did not witness any of that firsthand, he did survive another of World War II's deadliest situations, the Battle of the Bulge, and specifically the Siege of Bastogne. The 501st was awarded a Presidential Unit Citation for its performance there, surrounded by enemy forces, suffering nearly 600 casualties in the regiment, but holding its ground and helping the Allies thwart Hitler's last real chance at victory in Europe. There's quite a bit more to Mr. Harvey's story, so we took that rare step of extending this conversation to a second episode. If you missed the first part of his story last time, you can access that and all past episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. Mr. Harvey provided some poignant perspective on the seemingly arbitrary nature of casualties in war, illustrated by two men from his regiment who paid the ultimate price. I'm going to share just a brief excerpt of what he shared last week to prepare you for the rest of the story today. The 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment was the first element of the 101st Airborne Division to encounter the enemy during the Battle of the Bulge.
Strung them out in a line in the snow, and I told the first kid where the firefight was going on up ahead. I said, "Now you watch that man right there. And when he moves forward, you move forward. When he stops, you stop." So then I went back to each one of those kids and told them, I said, "You watch the boy in front of you, and you follow him." And then I got back so I wouldn't be leaving him behind. So this was in the snow and the woods and the trees and all the firing. Pretty soon the first kid come running back and yelling, "They're gone, they're gone, he's gone. He's gone." And I thought, oh, hell, because there was in there, got these six kids, got to join up with the others, and they're not going to know whether we're Germans or Americans. So went up and started yelling that we was coming in, we was Americans, friends, on, and we was coming into where they were. So I got them back in. We were coming back because it was morning. I come across the foxhole and took out three Germans out of the foxhole who'd knuckled down underneath there and stayed and let us go on by them, and was still there when we were coming back. So then I coming over, and they were carrying an American back. So I took the Germans and said, "We'll take him." So three prisoners I had, well, we carried the fella back across the river, the bridge, and when I got him to the first aid station, medic looked at him, says he's dead. So I took my prisoners, turned them back into the prisoner cage, and went back to headquarters. And when I got back there, they says, "Hurry up, we got a stand inspection." So what stand inspection? And Captain Howard came by, and he grabbed my rifle and looked at it and says, "It's dirty." I said, "Well, I was on the raid last night." So he knew he had made a mistake and gave him a rifle back, but went on down the line. I never did like the Captain Howard. A number of years later, I was living in Wichita on the fellow called me, who was a sergeant in charge of the medics. He was in Wichita, and we pick up his daughter. We were talking about things, and I told him about carrying the wounded man back on the plank board that we'd picked up. And he says, they brought Gulick back on a board. So I learned that it was Gulick. Well, then I found out Gulick had jumped in Normandy. He had fought in Holland. He had fought in Bastogne. He was in Alsace. And when he got hit and was killed, that was the last battle combat we were in. So he had, from Normandy to the last hour, if he'd got through that night, why, maybe Gulick's still around. So I remember those two, Don Fair and Gulick, one who was killed the first time he was in combat with no experience, and then Gulick, who was killed the very last hour.
And I could tell you've given that some thought over the years, and I guess my follow-up would be, is there something that you draw from that? That contrast that you painted, the differing circumstances or the different experience leading up to their death, but the fact that they were both two who paid that ultimate price. What do you take away from what you just told me?
Well, here is one boy in high school and the war. He didn't survive there one bit of it. So what would his life have been? And here was Gulick, who did all this combat and was killed at the end of his fighting career. What would his life have been? I know what mine has been, but what would theirs have been?
That is the question, isn't it? And how many of us wouldn't be here if our parents or grandparents had not survived World War II? I want you to hear the rest of Mr. Harvey's story now. We left off last time with him explaining that he spent Christmas Eve, Christmas, and his 20th birthday on December 26, 1944, protecting Allied officers holed up at the Chateau Ile-la-Hesse. So I'm just wondering, because you've had a lot of Christmases since that, 77 Christmases since that. Are there some things that you saw or experienced that Christmas that come back to mind sometimes when Christmas comes around?
No. Just there in the upstairs room, and we had to enter through the back door because that was the servant's entrance, and that's what we used. And so that was, we were inside a building. We were no longer outside. We were back behind the line, so we were, let's say, safe back there. You know, wouldn't have any machine gun, rifle fire, mortar fire. You could have shell fire, yes. But no, you got back. Why? Yeah, that was a safe place.
And just so I understand, I think what you're saying is the purpose of your being there was to protect the top brass that were holed up there.
Yes.
And that was Christmas, but the next day's your 20th birthday. What was that like?
Just the same as the day before and the day after.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
It wasn't any different. You're talking about religion. And I always said I was considerably older for I realize whose birthday they were celebrating at Christmas.
Well, and you didn't get to celebrate yours either, it sounds like. What about, I mean, I don't want to skip over anything that's important to you. But as, you know, days and days go by, and finally this tide is turned, and was there a moment where you realized that you guys weren't cut off anymore, that you weren't going to be stuck there, and that it wasn't going to end the way so many feared it would?
Well, as I say, when we were leaving and stuck there, why, previously we were on the defense. And when you're on your defense, why, you're in your foxhole, you're in this, you're in a safe place. When they're relieved, and we were in what was called the Bojack Woods, and on the offensive, and the fighting in the woods, then you're up out of that hole, and you're going into the fire. You're not there. So that was the difference in being surrounded and being relieved, is then's when we really got to casualties.
You're a lot more exposed in that position. And can you give us a feel for what that's like as you tried to advance? I mean, I'm just thinking about being in the woods. Fire of multiple kinds can be coming from anywhere.
I think that when you, just like when you've been back in reserve and you go up to relieve people on the line, you're back behind. Now, you're still in a danger area, but you're known rifle fire. Then as you march up, I think you get a little bit of a feel of apprehension because you know you're coming into a different situation each time, and the situation is closing as you get nearer and nearer and nearer till you leave that man in his foxhole so he can go back and you take over his foxhole. So you become apprehensive.
And, I mean, some of this may seem obvious for you, but, again, most people haven't lived through what you lived through. So I'm just curious. You mentioned rifle fire. That's one of the things that can happen to you. What are some of the other things that you had to, you know, be prepared for?
Well, you got mortar fire. You got artillery fire. Well, you can always, you hear the artillery coming. Mortar, you can hear a kind of a whir, but then it's bang. You know, there was a difference between an 88 and a 75. So these are sounds that you get used to, that you recognize that they're a dangerous sound.
So if you heard an 88, what would you do?
Well, it all depends on where you were, what's there. You reacted a different way. If you was in the foxhole, why, and you got to the bottom of it. If you was out in the open, you get to tell whether it's going over or not. And if it's coming close, why, you're going to hit the ground. And that's one of the things that people always in combat is what you call a short round. That round that it sounds like it's going over, and it doesn't. It hits.
It all sounds like a nightmare, I think, to most of us. And I'm just curious about something else there, because you talked about being in amongst the trees. Was the tree burst phenomenon something that you witnessed or had to watch out for?
Oh, you say witness, it's, yeah, the one when you're in that. But there again, you say witness. There's no witness to it. It... because it's coming through, and it's not at the end of its on.
And you did say, too, that, you know, it was after you went on the offensive that the casualties started to pile up. So I'm assuming that you're seeing these casualties. Some of these guys might have been pretty close to you.
All right. Now, I was in the S2 squad. The S2 squad's duties was to man the observation post and on. And the other thing was to take charge of the POWs. So let's say for a lot of it, we trailed along behind. So here was the squad up here, and then we were back here. And so let's say that they were doing the fighting, we were trailing along behind. So there again, I was, let's say, fortunate most of the time that... my duties were a little different from the rifleman, although I was a rifleman in the S2 squad. Their job was a little different than what mine was.
I don't know if this is an easy question to answer, but you've handled every question so far, so why not? Is there something that you look back on and you say, this was the most challenging aspect of what I did in World War II? Something that was the most difficult for you to deal with?
Nothing I recall.
Nothing fazed you?
No. I was, let's say, I was growing up. The one thing, when I got discharged, I had just turned 21, and I was coming through the separation center, which was also an induction center, because they were still drafting 18-year-olds. Here I come through, and I looked, and I thought, my goodness, these are kids. I didn't think of myself as a kid when I was 18 and going into the service. But yet, when I looked at them, I thought, yeah, they're kids.
Anything that I don't ask you about that you think is important, feel free to add in there. But there's all these things that we know that happened in World War II. Then there's a lot of things that could have happened and almost happened that we don't always hear about. And am I understanding correctly that you guys, before VE Day, were preparing to potentially make a combat jump to try to liberate some of the prisoner of war camps where Americans and Brits were held by the Germans?
They were afraid, the upper brass, was that the Germans would start to annihilate POWs, or that they would try to move them, and they would be in no physical condition to be moved. So they assigned, kept us back to, if they got rumors or evidence that this was going to happen, why, we would jump and protect them on. And so we, the 501 of the 101st, and then there was another regiment, I think the 82nd, were on alert. We were both up near Reims. While we were there on this alert, there was a group of soldiers who came in to our headquarters company, and they ate in our mess, but they kept separate from us. They kept by themselves, and they were radio men who were there to be contacted in case, you know, they'd contact them.
Those radio guys would be coordinating or passing along information if you had to deploy that way.
Yes.
And how did you feel about that possibility of jumping into a heavily defended POW camp?
Well, we didn't know. They it was just a job. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of a lot of the POWs who I've talked to. And at that point, you know, some of them had only been there a few weeks. Others had been there for months. A lot of them are starving. They're losing weight. They've seen guys shot by the guards. They've seen people try to escape and be executed as a result. And they didn't know what was going on. And it was so desperate for them. I'm just imagining what it would have meant to them if you guys risked your own lives to set them free. Did you have any idea what POWs had been going through over there?
Oh, no. No, there was no. Now an aside.
Yeah.
Did you know about Patton's son-in-law?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a story by itself. He sacrificed a battalion.
That is a whole story of its own, and we've heard some of that story on Hometown Heroes. If you have the time and you want to hear that story, head over to hometownheroesradio.com and pull up episode number 354, and you can learn about General Patton's son-in-law, John K. Waters, from Alan Dunbar, who told us Waters saved his life in Stalag 7A. There's much more to come in this episode with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico, including what it was like to march through New York City in the Victory Parade when he came home from World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.